So I have a poem to start out today. It's called A Lizard in Spanish Valley by Wendy Vitalak. A lizard does not make a sound. It has no song. It does not share my love affairs with flannel sheets, bearded men, interlocking silver rings, the moon, the sea, or ink. But sitting here the afternoon, I've come to believe we do share a love affair and a belief in wink, blink, stone, and heat, also air. This is not a fable, nor is it bliss. Impatience, remember this. So today we'll be talking about Kshanti Paramita, the perfection of tolerance or patience. Kshanti is translated from Pali or Sanskrit as tolerance, patience, forbearance. It means unaffected by, able to bear, able to understand, and implies imperturbable and well composed. So that you could also call it the perfection of composure. Kshanti has a long history in the early Pali Sutras. Shantideva states that there's no spiritual practice equal to tolerance. Tolerance is used in the midst of adversity, and when cultivated, bodhisattvas are able to withstand danger, suffering, abuse, injustice, and they can withstand the onslaught of negative emotions even while under stress. So we would consider character shortcomings, weaknesses, as seen in the tendency to lose focus, become fearful, or react in anger. And it can also show up in terms of retaliation. So you might see someone retaliate if they experience some abuse or slight to their ego or their body. And at the extreme level, we would say that there's intolerance when the person yields to temptation of surrender or despair. So we have a full range here.
Would you say that last sentence again, please?
So if in the extreme sense, if you're intolerant, you might surrender to despair, or you might surrender to despair. So tolerance or patience really isn't passivity or weakness. It actually has a tremendous power associated with it that comes out of patience or tolerance. In the way of the Bodhisattva, Kshanti is divided into three different categories. First, you have the tolerance to withstand personal suffering. And then there's the tolerance to tolerate the abuse or injury from others, so outside yourself. And then there's third, which is the capacity to tolerate other views of reality that undermine your long-standing habits of mental insecurity.
Could you say that sentence again?
I know, it's so mouthful. So it's the capacity to tolerate other views of reality that undermine one's habitual way of thinking in terms of their mental insecurity. So you all caught that. So it has to do with how one perceives themselves. So, for example, if you perceive yourself as being not egocentric, and then somebody calls you egocentric because you really are, then that would be area of contention for you, and you might exhibit retaliatory behavior. So, in the case that, so now we're looking at bodhisattvas having that capacity to tolerate that. If you have an ego and somebody calls you egotistical, you don't lash out, is basically the practice. So, endurance, this tolerance for discomfort, for pain, for poverty, for hardship, is really grounded in the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. Nobody escapes. Nobody. We are all going to get sick, have injuries, and we will all die. So, from a bodhisattva perspective, one considers thoughtfully and courageously discomfort, hardship, poverty, and pain. And the way you do it is to first accept that there is suffering. That's the First Noble Truth. So turn your mind to acceptance. That will start. And then, secondly, when you're facing these difficulties, don't waste your energy on this looping in, you know, that will be destructive thoughts or habits of that, you know, basically deal with dejection or rejection or despair. So avoid those kinds of behaviors or mental processes. Basically, move away from negative thoughts. Extricate yourself from negative thoughts and emotions. So Shantideva, who is the author of The Way of the Bodhisattva, says that there's only through suffering is there escape. In other words, through suffering we learn to face adversity and deepen our strengths. And maybe you have some thoughts on that one. So I have a story for you on patience in terms of human relations, and the title of it is Temper. A Zen student asked Bankei and complained. He didn't ask him, he came to Bankei and he complained. He says, "Master, I have an ungovernable temper. How can I care for it? How can I cure it?" Bankei says, "You have something very strange. Let me see what you have." "Well, just now I can't show it to you," replied the monk. "When can you show it to me?" It arises unexpectedly, replied the student. Then, concluded Bankei, it must not be your true nature. If it were, you could show it to me at any time. When you were born, you did not have it, and your parents didn't give it to you. Think that over. So patience in human relationships. There's a lot of classical teachings on patience. The Dalai Lama has done, I think, like a week-long seminar on patience. You can actually get it on DVD or CDs. And I think it's now even in written form. And we also have, you know, Shantideva, as I mentioned. So most teachers will, at some point, work with their students on the topic of anger. And the reason is that it's really an important topic, too, because it's been taught that generosity, morality, no matter all that, you know, good work can be destroyed by hatred. It's quite destructive. It's considered one of the three poisons on the wheel of life and death: greed, hate, and delusion. So it's very fundamental and can permeate our human interactions. So, hatred destroys lives. And the perfection of tolerance is the capacity to react with equanimity towards all situations. I have some antidotes to anger. Maybe you have some of your own. But the first one is calming meditation. So there's a, during meditation, one would reflect on the negative things that are done to us, might be a result of past karmic actions. And then you might reflect on the idea that those who treat us unjustly really are teachers to us. And then the third could be a reflection on dependent arising. In other words, depersonalize the affront or injustice that's presented to you. And recognize that it arises independent on something. So, reflection on dependent arising and no self are excellent starting points or antidotes to investigate how to respond. Now, moving into a really deep level of tolerance is, I think, what you were talking about earlier, or about maybe yesterday. Milarepa had said that, claims that being beyond being without fear of what is ultimately true, there is no other tolerance. So, what is ultimately true? There is no self. And this can bring up all kinds of fear, anxiety, and as practitioners, it's really essential that we learn and understand the emptiness of all things, including the emptiness of self. This is how one transforms one's life. Emptiness is understanding emptiness and realizing emptiness are the way forward in the practice. Yes.
I've been struggling since the first day when you talked about emptiness.
Yes.
I have a hard time understanding the word emptiness, mm-hmm. the way we use it. In my head, I prefer the word nothing. It makes more sense to me, but because emptiness to me implies a space that is empty, where I don't think that's what you mean. I wondered if you could just explain somehow what emptiness means in the context that we use it in our practice.
Okay. So, when you said nothingness, that's a word that people also used early on, and they also called it voidness. And that also gives you one the idea that there's nothing there. But emptiness isn't about nothing being there. In fact, just the opposite. Emptiness, when we talk about emptiness, it's about the inherent lack of self-existence. In other words, because everything is changing all the time, everything. The Teigen, I think, has a very good definition of tolerance. He says the fundamental practice of patience is for the constant changing of the ungraspability of all of phenomena. Can you grasp right now the totality of everything in the entire universe changing moment by moment? Every cell, everything in this room, everything in this whole world. Can you possibly grasp that? That changing, when we talk about this process of change and of impermanence, nothing's fixed. So how can we grasp it? So it isn't to say that you don't exist. That's not it. It's to say how you exist. You exist independent on something else. You're here because of your parents, and then because of previous teachers, or because of some other experience, because of a book you read, because of myriad reasons of why each of you are here. So if that's the case, we would say you're empty of inherent self-existence. You do not exist separate from anybody else in this room, from anybody else, from anything in the universe, because everything is interconnected. Nothing is separate. So when we're talking like this, we're speaking about its ultimate nature. So conventionally, we all recognize we're sitting here. We all exist. But how we exist is independent on something else. And that's, we refer to that as emptiness.
So it's empty of a concept, of our concept of the thing.
You could, yes, that's, it's empty of, there are, well, I won't want to confuse you too much, but there are, you know,
don't worry about that.
18 kinds of emptiness, or then 20 kinds of emptiness. Anyway, so yes, one of them is the concept of who you think you are, who mm-hmm. I think I am. Mm-hmm. That I think I exist as a fixed entity. Mm-hmm. I think I exist, you know, this is Val right here. But it isn't. I'm breathing air that, you know, we're sharing the air here. How am I separate at a very basic level. I'm breathing to exist.
So I was reading Okamura the other day, and he was talking about the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. He was trying to define what is the river. Is it the water that comes at the beginning of it? Is it at the delta? What mm-hmm. is it? Mm-hmm. And it's neither or both of those things. And mm-hmm. so what I grasp, he didn't say it, is that if you extend from the idea of river, you can extend it to pretty much everything is the river.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I thought to myself, well, some ground in Connecticut. Mm. If I were to move that ground, somehow that's also supporting that river.
Mm-hmm.
So. So when they say emptiness is form and form is emptiness, mm-hmm. there is, I'm just trying to understand that word empty.
Sure.
And there, like I've seen it translated as boundlessness. We have mm-hmm. that one mm-hmm. of our.
That's Tanahashi.
Right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so it's both. The river's both. It is both a river and it's not a river.
That's true.
Okay.
Conventionally, it's a river, but it's not a river.
Right.
In its ultimate sense.
Okay.
Because a river is just a name. Mm-hmm. It's a label. Mm-hmm. If we look at isness, mm-hmm. of what's going on right now at this moment, nothing has a label. Mm-hmm. Everything, nothing and has a label. Mm-hmm. We impute a label. We designate a label. I'm Val, this is Cliff, you know, these are Zabutons. So those labels are, what happens is we misunderstand the labels. We accept the labels and say it's the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's confusing. Yes, Anna?
This is really goes into linguistics, like the nature of language. Like
mm-hmm.
language is inherently stable because a word is just a sign and a signifier or like a concept over a sound image, and it's just this agreed upon thing, river. But when mm-hmm. you deconstruct it, is what is river? It's water, it's blue, it's, and then my idea of river is different than everybody's in this room.
Mm-hmm.
So like the meaning is inherently empty. So like the nature of the label. Yes.
mm-hmm.
Yes. Agreement. Yes. And this is my language.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that.
So this is how we can say we're void of self. Because who is the self today that you're showing me? What is your true face? You know, that's always the big question in Zen, right? What is your original face? What does that mean? That's your true self. Not the self you're presenting to me at this moment in time, because another moment you're somebody else. Technically speaking, you've changed, as we all have. It's just really hard to grasp that. Yes?
Do you think there's a physical or emotional component to this understanding? Like, I noticed when it came into the Zendo and sat down. Like, when I think back about that, I felt heavier, like I was more there. And the more I study Zen, in mm-hmm. some ways I know more, in some ways I know less, but I don't, something changes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel emptier.
Maybe less fixed.
Yeah. I mean, I
solid.
Bizarre, but I still don't understand the word. But.
Well, I think it has to be realized. So we start with the intellectual understanding, and one of them is through the, I think in Tibetan, Nagarjuna has a sevenfold reasoning. You know, it's very much as Anna was saying. Well, or even Chris was saying. Well, you know, you're not the water from that river, that water could come from the ocean. You know, I mean, it's like what makes up that river. So moment by moment, in you know what is it, and how can you actually say this is a river? Same with the South, as it's changing and going through growth and realization.
Yeah, it just seems to drop by throughout. Like, it seems like nothing happens in Zazen,
but everything happens.
You're like, oh, things felt different.
Right, that's a transformative quality of Zazen. Yes.
For me, the answer lies in looking to where the river ends and the ocean starts.
Can you find it?
No, and that's the beauty, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I think we all take something different away from the Dharma talk. My big moment when you gave that talk 2 days ago was emptiness. I finally, it was wonderful for me because it was like emptiness all along. Just the sound of emptiness has always just been part of the austerity of Zen, which my personality is really not predisposed to at all, you know, despite the fact that I subject myself to it. And so it was really beautiful to hear it described in terms of basic, like, interdependence and just the unity of life. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually, that was actually something that I really took away from the talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interconnectedness. Yes, Holger.
I don't think it's important that we understand emptiness. I certainly don't. I think I understand intellectually. But I think that the realization of emptiness, that's what we're after.
Mm.
Isn't that awakening?
Yes. It starts, though, with, you know, because we're Westerners, you know, we need to have some intellectual understanding of this. That's probably my own bias making that statement, but yes, realize, yes, the realization of emptiness and, comes through your practice.
So if we're not there yet, that's okay.
That's true.
When I was starting out, I just repeated over and over the inherent lack of self existence. In and of itself, you, Tika, in and of itself, it does not exist. Just start there.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't exist separately.
I'm not far past that, so.
Well, I often question all the talking that we do in all the books and all the reading and all the philosophy and everything, but having read this thing the other night and then coming in Zazen the next day, and I did, that's why I brought it up, because I did have, sure, I understood what he was saying in that essay, but it was in Zazen that I realized, oh, everything's the river. And it was a different sort of a feeling, but it was because I originally read the essay and thought about it, somehow it was transferred, and now I have a different I don't know what you call it. I grokked it differently now.
You realized it. You realized it. That's what happened. You realized the teaching. And that is really, Chris, the reason people read is you take a phrase, something you don't understand, and you can bring it into your Zazen. And we'll talk a little bit more about that during the Paramita of meditation. Because it is important to realize the teachings. I mean, that's the Buddha's instructions. Don't take my word for it. Realize for yourself. I can't realize for you. You have to do the work. And the way you do the work is just the process you went through. Yes.
Good. A slightly different approach to this, starting from Kashanti or patience. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the word inclusiveness almost.
Mm.
So inclusiveness is also another approach to realizing no self, essentially, that you include progressively.
It's inclusive, because I read the six paramitas in Thich Nhat Hanh's book, so I got confused when they were named differently here. So is inclusiveness the Which paramita is he talking about when he...
Patience.
So he's, what he's emphasizing is really non-duality by the word inclusiveness. So there's, his teaching is that anger is not only not essential to the insistence on justice, but he says there's no other way through it. In other words, he is linking and expressing the non-duality of the perpetrator and the victim. There's no separation between the two. And this approach of non-duality is why there is no need for a violent response. Is his position. Because if you position yourself in reality together, that's a very different position than to take self and other and separate, as opposed to being together in reality. It's a shift away from separateness. It's emphasizing interconnectedness, inclusion, non-duality.
In the verses in the faith mind, there's that line that always sticks with me about if you have doubt, just say not to.
Yes.
And that not to, nothing is lacking, nothing is in excess.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's an excellent chant for really taking individual phrases and then working with that in vipassana, in insight meditation, because it will help you investigate that and look at it from different aspects and then actually realize the teachings, as Chris experienced himself.
Yes, I have a question about what you said about, let's say, like, you know, two people together are really one.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say one person is doing the other one great damage.
Mm-hmm.
Even life-threatening damage.
Mm-hmm.
So the second person doesn't look for some sort of justice, as we say in this country at least? I mean...
No, Thich Nhat Hanh would say, the teaching is that there is no separateness. So, of course, you know, we would say we can discuss...
Well, I'm talking...
Tolerance, or how tolerant is one to injustice?
No, I mean, it's easy to get theoretical, so I'll be more specific. One person rapes the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Then what? What does the other person do?
Well, I mean, one would take action in the sense of you can go the normal route that we have in our society for those kinds of violent acts, right? That's one thing. It's what would be... The perfection, though, of that, when you're talking about tolerance, I mean, after the act has happened and one has been violated, there is, and you've done what you needed to do to inform the proper authorities and let it be transferred over. I guess the issue would be is how much are you holding on to that then yourself? How will you remain in that feeling of being violated? And will anger arise and hatred arise because of that act? And that's the part that as a practitioner you would be working with. Because the act is over now,
mm-hmm.
but the traces are still there.
Mm-hmm.
But does it serve you to the question would be, does it serve you to hold on to hatred?
Well, in this situation, the person was found and taken to court.
Right.
So now, if I testify,
mm-hmm.
I mean, am I just holding on to it, and so I go?
Oh no, you're also in society, so you're also protecting other people in society. Through your own willingness to take that step, because you know, for example, women in India are really violated frequently, and they're not protected in society. So in the sense of the government doesn't necessarily protect them in the same way that ours does. So is it situational what makes more sense? That's why women in India don't report crimes. Yeah. Women in the United States more frequently will report the incident. So, again, the issue of context, cultural influences, and, how one will respond to injustice. And what would we do? What would you do, or you, in different situations? What is your tolerance level? Yes.
I work with a lot of young women that are dealing with bullying in their school hallways, or working with a young woman right now who was just raped a couple of weeks ago. And so I encourage the constructive action, alongside the practice of, staying present and being with that equanimity of the truth of what is. Because, it's almost like doing what needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
and then just practicing, the truth mm-hmm. of life.
Right. You can't undo the act. So it doesn't serve one to stay into it and hold on to it. And, in fact, it actually undermines your ability to be present. So it's an important way forward for people to let go. It's not that you don't, as you say, take action
mm-hmm.
and then protect yourself going forward
mm-hmm.
because you learn from your mistakes, or you learn from this, how things happened, that you have to take it forward rather than hang out in the past.
So I think my question is about tolerating other people being hurt or abused.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if I was just patient and completely tolerant, then I would never step in to protect or change any injustice that's happening
mm-hmm.
everywhere around me.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's a place where patience is not necessarily, there's a balance between patience and action.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my question is, if I'm practicing patience, where is that too much patience because I'm not acting in a beneficial way that's appropriate?
Mm-hmm.
Or that's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Yes.
I mean, appropriate's big.
Mm. Right.
It's appropriate to let other people suffer, and it's also appropriate to go and fight for them. So,
mm-hmm.
there's a big range of appropriate, but I don't have a lot of tolerance for other people being hurt needlessly in ways that I can see is going to be repeated.
Mm-hmm. That's in there too. If we look at the historical sutras, for example, there really isn't anything in there, like in the early discourse, in the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, the early stories of the Buddha, because the emphasis was really on individual liberation. So when you think about looking for patience in the context of social injustice, or as we know of abuse, you know, child abuse or elder abuse or violence, those kinds of things weren't dealt with in the early sutras. So we don't have that as a frame of reference. But what we do have today is the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. That's one area that you can participate in an organized and engaged way. And they do focus on injustices, whether it's for prisoners or for other causes. There might be, I don't know the full spectrum of all their engaged activities. But certainly on a personal level, you can take action. I mean, we're very fortunate in America. In some ways, we have the ability to exercise our rights and express what we see as abuse and to the proper authorities. Yes. Yes.
And we have some wonderful role models, like Gandhi was a beautiful example of, you know, major revolution through peaceful means, you know, nonviolent. Mm-hmm. He, like, led the way, you know, for his whole people. And the Dalai Lama, who over and over again has tried to enter into talks with the Chinese, despite the Chinese, you know, like, burning up all his people. And Aung San Suu Kyi, I think, is another
yes.
really magical
mm-hmm.
example.
Burma.
People that do it, they're acting, and they're acting without violence. And I think that's the way forward for us now, because we can't be inactive with mm-hmm. the world in the state that it's in.
Mm-hmm. And also to piggyback off of that, I think patience is action.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, the center, I feel like the core of this violence, the separation of genders and races, is dualism.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole reason that violence happens. It's like, you know, black, white, male, female, trans. Like,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe patience helps a person laugh instead of get angry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that impresses me about some writers and commentators that I appreciate is they say, look at this, isn't this funny? Whereas I'd look at it and I'd get mad. But they look at it and they can laugh at it, and yet it might be the patience of a parent that says, look at this. And so it's, way faster than where you can get with anger, I guess. There was another part of this topic that we haven't talked much about yet, and it's late in this period, but you brought up about how suffering can actually help us develop patience.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's a lot about what Zazen is for me. and it's like, I haven't had enough suffering in my life, but I come here and I get plenty of it. And so it kind of greases the wheels for the rest of my life, where it's a little easier. I don't know. Do other people have that experience?
No.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, I was wondering, never mind. I was going to ask you, I noticed in Zazen that I seem to be doing a lot of it in the last few days, that, like, sometimes I don't have much pain, and I'm looking at the wall, and then if things were going good for too long, this frustration arises,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and it will find the pain, it will find problems, but it's all, like, I'm sitting there and I'm fine, and then this frustration just wants to take me off the mat.
Mm.
So I was wondering, do you have any practices to cultivate patience rather than that frustration? Because I could use it.
Well, what's happening is the mind is resisting. It's a form of resistance, actually, what you're experiencing. So the mind doesn't want to be trained. So just when things are going along really good, it's going to give you a little... So the mind is a real tricky thing. You know, the ego is a trickster. And so you have to be on guard for that. And if you can observe it, that that's what's going on, then it's easier to let it go. So just like, I don't know if any of you have had this experience in Zazen where you get real restless. Nobody, it's just like... So, and sometimes it's so bad, you would just jump up if you were in private. You would just jump up from your cushion and do something else. I've done it myself. But it's another form of resistance. And resistance to mind training mm-hmm. is really what it is. So there are these subtle, changes that we might experience in Zazen are actually... they're actual classic hindrances. Classic hindrances. Mm-hmm. Restlessness, worry. I mean, the list goes on. Aversion, attachment. sometimes we're really tired. Sloth. Or, you know. So our Zazen will, you know, have all of those at some point in your life show up. And they might stay with you for a period. Restlessness might stay with you for a period of, I mean, not just one Zazen. I mean, we're talking a period of time, you know, like a month or it could be any period, but where you just can't tolerate. You just, it's really hard to sit. For whatever reason, the mind is just like saying, yeah. So, maybe we could talk a little bit about some antidotes to anger. Yes?
Just continuing with the Zazen connection and patience, Zazen is a practice in presence. Mm-hmm. It's one of the many things. If we're going to try to define it at all, I mean,
yes.
It's probably not really necessary to say anything. As Kota Zawaki would say, you know, Zazen is good for nothing.
Daddy would. Daddy did.
So, you know, your question about the anger is to become present.
Mm-hmm.
And, as we do with waiting for each breath to come in mm-hmm. Zazen and Kini, get back to the breath, get back to the moment when something is tempting anger or mm-hmm. suggesting anger or prompting anger, and come back present for a few moments and see if there's really a reason. Sometimes there would be a reason, and anger is necessary for survival.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing to check it out first and see if it's one of those most frequent times when it can be not brought into reality by presence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think it's because of its destructive nature, it's important to really investigate when anger arises. And particularly, you might want to look at the causes and conditions. You might want to look at the triggers for you. And really make it a practice to study that, because It's very destructive. You know, you can see the suffering you cause with anger. You can see it for the other person, for yourself, and you know, just there's just a lot of antidotes that you can work with if you just put forth the intention to start really investigating how anger arises for you. How it starts with frustration and or irritation and then just moves along. Because if you can't tolerate even irritation, you know, feeling irritated, then that's going to even open up the door for anger to show up much quicker. You have to be able to hold that space, hold it when you feel irritated and let it go. I mean, there's nothing to be irritated about. Is that whatever is irritating you is empty. What you're empty, it's empty. You know, use the teachings to liberate yourself. That is what we're here to do, to practice in that way. It's because if we can't do it, how can, you know, the Klansmen down in Arkansas or North Carolina do it? We have to do it. You have to start. So, you know, put forth that intention and start looking at causes and conditions, because anger is habitual. Yes.
Can you explain to me the difference? Just because I was raised in a culture that was very repressive towards anger, mm-hmm. and then there was a lot of danger with, there was a lot of anger but wasn't talked about, and then it was just like kind of put in a neat box and then very dangerous. The like difference between, is it being present with anger and then in repression?
Well, repression seems to me is like a kind of ignoring something. So that's not like facing reality, right? So in whether anger comes out or whether it's, you know, hidden or repressed, in any case, they both have causes and conditions. So it's what you're talking about is really the expression of those feelings. One is repressed and one is expressed outwardly. Mm-hmm. So you still have causes and conditions. You still have triggers. Mm-hmm. That doesn't go away. So you still need to investigate what's that about. What seemed to give rise to those emotions. Mm-hmm. Our everyday life actually gives us lots of clues if we really look deeply at our conditioning. We don't really recognize how much we're influenced by our conditioning. It's really amazing. So when I'm talking about conditioning, I'm talking about the order of you and the family. Are you the first child, the second child, third child? You know, are you, how about your family situation, the dynamics? Are you from a single parent family? Were you raised in culturally in a different belief system? Did you have different practices? Where did you go to school? What were you taught? What was emphasized? You know, I mean, all of this, and it continues. Today, you are being conditioned. Can you see it? So, we are, you know, creatures of habit. We come from some place that is a result of many causes and conditions. And so, also, the work we do is to investigate. You know, how does something come about? So back to your example, Chris, so good to you to bring up about the river, because everything is like that. So if some feeling comes up in yourself, some idea, you think it should be this way, why isn't it, you know, it this is the way it has to be, or I believe this, you know, and you hear yourself say this. When that comes up, right away, question, what was my conditioning in this? Where's the conditioning in this? What belief, did this come from my family? Was I taught this in school? Did I learn this, you know, from my friends? Where did this come from? And then you want to say, does it hold true? Or is it just something that we have stored in our, you know, consciousness and subconscious, and it came out, and there it is, and we believe it. And then we're acting on it. So conditioning is very deep. Very deep indeed. Did somebody have a question or a comment? Had enough of tolerance? Are you done with tolerance? Are we putting patience away? Well, we had a good discussion here, and let's see. Some practices for the perfection of tolerance, and how we're going to go to, you know, another extreme from injustice to perfection. And one of them is, first, do not indulge in resentment. Mm-hmm. There's one. And then be mindful of the rise of arrogant mind states. This will allow you to take into account the diversity that we experience here. And we're very fortunate, actually, in the Bay Area to have so much diversity. Not only in terms of people's ideas and, you know, practices, but, you know, so we have greater exposure to all of these differences, but also sameness. And not to ignore the sameness in reality, which is the interconnectedness of all of us. Thank you.